thank you very much, Tom, for that introduction. I'm a bit fearful, though, when you tell people I've worked 3 months on this presentation, because, as I shared, that means you'll have a very, very high expectation. And I just assume you have a low expectation and be pleasantly surprised. But it's a great pleasure to be here this morning with you for this 40th anniversary. I'm going to work from up here for the first part of this talk, and then as we get into the presentations, move down such that we can really study some of the responses to your questions. I've been charged with the task of talking about the crossroads or the transitions that we see on the horizon in the seed stock and the beef industry. And your program planning committee empathized with the early founders of the BIF in that we know that they had to feel somewhat overwhelmed at all of the technology and all of the data and all of the lack of standardization that was present in a rather immature seed stock industry at the time. And during that empathizing, we also recognize that isn't it interesting that as much as things have changed, things are also very much the same, in that we currently, still today, feel rather inundated with how to cope with technology and ever-expanding information. So I'm going to talk about some of these crossroads we are facing. You can use the term crossroads or you can use the term transition, but we really do feel like we're in a period of greater transition than we have been in a number of years. And during the talk, I'd like to also talk about a little bit about who benefits from performance program and genetic improvement and at what cost and who pays. And to get right into that, I wanted to set this up by saying I'm going to try to answer these questions from the standpoint of the service sector, the breed associations that provide data processing information services. Dr. Ronnie Green is going to talk about it more from the research angle and his capacity at ARS. And then finally, Brian McCullough is going to address this topic from the standpoint of the user, of the breeder, of commercial producers that put this technology to work to hopefully generate greater profits. I wanted to start this morning just by emphasizing how large our industry is. We work with a huge industry, don't we? A giant industry. And I just want to bookend this by saying, according to Cattle Facts, we've got nearly 750,000 producers. That's huge. It's mind-boggling. On the other bookend, we serve a potential 300 million consumers in this country alone. So we work with a massive industry. It's huge. And there's huge dollars at stake as well. I pulled this from a variety of sources, but in 2005, consumers spent just over $71 billion on beef products. The indirect and direct employment of the beef industry encompasses 1.4 million full-time equivalent positions. At the same time, annual gross receipts from the sales of cattle and calves alone exceeds $40 billion. And if you look at the total effect of the beef industry on the U.S. economy, it amounts to nearly $190 billion annually worth of activity. It's huge. It's giant. It's almost incomprehensible for many of us that work in our little corner of the world of the industry. At the same time, I want to try to build a case for the rather minuscule amount that we invest in genetic programs, research, and decision support type activity. I can only speak from the breed association perspective alone, but a few years ago, Dr. Tom Field and Travis Christman, who's now at ABS, conducted a survey of all the breed associations. And I think it included the 15 largest breed associations, Tom. And you asked us, how much do you spend on software development? How much do you spend on genetic evaluation? That one is termed analysis in this slide. How much do you spend on information technology staff? How much do you spend on data entry? And how much do you spend on reporting? In other words, generation of sire summaries and other kinds of report materials. And what we learned was over the course of that 10-year period from 93 to 2002, the industry invested approximately $30 million, or in other words, about $3 million per year over that decade. And a couple of interesting observations I wanted to make was that isn't it interesting that we spend six times as much on monetary support of punching the data than we actually spend on the analysis of the data? And shouldn't we be so ever thankful for all of the land-grant institutions that have provided such subsidized genetic evaluation services for our industry over the years? They have provided us untold benefit at such minuscule cost that alone is almost incomprehensible. And I found that rather interesting. As we go forward, we'll talk a little bit later about breed associations and how they are likely to change. This is likely to be shifted, isn't it, to the seed stock producer. This must increase if we're going to be competitive globally, and some of these other costs are also likely to change. So, the question is too much riding on too little? And what is the opportunity cost or the price that we might pay for underfunded, understaffed, fragile, antiquated performance programs, research, and genetic evaluation infrastructure? And I'd like to have that kind of be in the back of your mind as I address some of these topics and as Ronnie and as Brian talk about these topics. How can we create an infrastructure that is well-funded, robust, adequately staffed, with assertive and innovative implementation of cutting, leading-edge technology that's adequately communicated to all the users? That's really, in many of our minds, I think, the question as we go into the future. Now, there's some precedent around the world for the return on investment in genetic improvement. And the Australians have done a nice job just in the last several years at documenting this. The Australians claim a 28-to-1 return on investment in genetic improvement. The folks in Ontario claim over a 3-to-1 return on investment in genetic improvement. So the improvement relative to investment opportunity is certainly there. So the four or five topics I'm going to talk quickly with you about today are the crossroads or the transitions that we see on the horizon relative to genetic evaluation, genomics, decision support, and at the breed association level. And I'm going to have you help me do it by answering a few questions. So if you get your responders now, the first question I'd like to ask you is, do you have the selection tools needed to reliably make desired genetic improvement in the traits that you are interested in? And I'll let you define those traits. But one means no, not for most traits. So you're rather dissatisfied about the tools available to you. Two would say no, not for at least some traits. Three is neutral. In other words, yes for some, but no for some others. Four is yes for most traits, but not for maybe a handful. And then five would be yes for nearly all traits. Five would be yes for nearly all traits. And everyone can vote. Now, obviously, if everybody votes five, we're in great shape, and there's not much work yet to be done. So most of you are in the middle, and I think that makes sense. Next question. And this is a little different question depending on whether you're a seed stock producer or a commercial producer. And the question is, do you know you're within herd genetic trends if you're a seed stock producer? And by this I mean not just know whether or not your averages for the different traits are better or worse than the averages for all active animals in your breed, but do you know your individual trends? In other words, the average EPDs for animals in each birth year for each trait. Now, if you're a commercial producer, the question is a little different. We don't expect you to know all those things, but we want to know, do you know your phenotypic trends for key traits? And we'll let you define the traits. In other words, do you know how you've done over the last 5-10 years on preg rate, weaning rate, weaning weight? You can define the key traits. So let's vote. You know, we spend a great deal of time in the months leading up to this period of the year making our sire selection decisions. And we contemplate them and match cows with bulls. And isn't it interesting how some of us really don't even know what trend we created even through the agonization of all those decisions. But this group is very progressive in that most of you have a pretty good idea, don't you? You got a pretty good idea. Next question. This one is a fun one, and we threw this in for entertainment value. And it is primarily for, let's just have the seed stock producers vote on this one. I want just the seed stock producers to vote. I promise anonymity on this one. This will not be tracked. It will not be published, but we want to honestly know, how do you most commonly collect birth weight data? One, you don't collect it. Two, visually with your eyeball. Three, with a hoof tape that predicts birth weight. Or four, with a scale. Four with a scale is the correct answer, and I'm happy to see that most of you got that right. That reminds me of kind of a funny little joke, and I hope you find it funny. You've maybe heard this, but sometimes we mix up our language when it comes to statistics. And I'll tell you a little joke about a guy named John. A guy named John was partying with his buddies, and he got home rather late, and his wife met him at the door, and his wife was mad. She was hot, and she said, "John, you knew it was our 10-year wedding anniversary. What in the world were you thinking? You forgot all about our wedding anniversary, and you better have something in the driveway in the morning that goes from 0 to 160 in less than 60 seconds. John, wanting to save his marriage, took his wife pretty seriously. And the next morning, they got up, and the wife went to the door and looked out the front window. And sure enough, in the driveway, there's this beautiful gift, perfectly wrapped with a nice bow on top. It wasn't an actual car, but she was hopeful and went to the driveway and picked up the gift and very excited, unwrapped it and was getting ready to open the box. And she opened the box and inside was the brightest, shiniest bathroom scale she'd ever seen. John's not with us any longer. Next question, which of the following best describes your use of ultrasound scan data in selection? One, I do not use scan information when making selection decisions. Two, I primarily use the actual scan measures. Three, I primarily use yearling adjusted scan measures and ratios. Or four, I primarily use interim carcass or scan EPDs that incorporate the animal's scan data. Survey says, good. For the most part, we're using at least the adjusted information or the ratios, and in most cases, the EPDs. And that is, I think, the best way to use that data. Next question. is a companion question relative to the carcass trait area. Which of the following best describes your efforts to have actual carcass data collected on your cattle? One, I have never collected much carcass data. Two, I collected some carcass data in past years, but not much in recent years. Three, I've begun collecting more lately. Or four, I have routinely collected significant amounts of carcass data. We have a hypothesis here that we're going to prove whether or not it's true. So the most common answer is, I have routinely collected significant amounts of carcass data. That's great. That surprises me a little bit, because I was anticipating a higher proportion of you would answer number two, to collected some in past, but not much in recent years, thinking that perhaps some of our efforts to collect carcass data have been diminished in that we've collected ultrasound scan data instead. And I think the takeaway there is, the more we can routinely collect significant amounts of all kinds of data, all the better. So, great response. Interesting. Oh, yes, let's go ahead and break that out rather relative to seed stock and commercial. This is seed stock, okay? And this is commercial. Wow. God bless you commercial producers for the high incidence of you that routinely collect significant amounts of that data. Thanks for the reminder on the breakout. Next question, and these are going to be fun questions. They're leading up to some takeaways that we want to share with you relative to some crossroads relative to performance programs. Do you currently produce hybrid seed stock if you're a seed stock producer? And do you currently use hybrid seed stock if you're a commercial producer? And we'll break the results out depending on what type of producer you are. So if you're a seed stock producer, do you produce hybrids? If you're a commercial producer, do you use hybrids? So these are seed stock. This is total. So in total, there's a little over half of you that either produce or use hybrid seed stock. Here's seed stock. The minority of you produce hybrids if you are a seed stock producer. But the majority, 73% of you, if you're a commercial producer in attendance at this meeting, use hybrid seed stock. And isn't that difference interesting? A follow-up question to that. What do you anticipate regarding the future production or use of hybrid seed stock? And everyone should vote on this one. So in the future, and let's just say the future is the next decade time horizon, do you anticipate, one, declining production and use of hybrids? Two, stable but stagnant production and use? Three, increased production and use? Or four, dramatically increased production and use? I think we had about 40% of seed stock currently producing in this. So the most common answer is three, increased production and use, stable and dramatically increased is about equal. So only 4% saw a decline. So interesting, we can expect that to have a meaningful impact on our industry. Next question. Have you tested or used any of the DNA diagnostics for quantitative traits? Actually, I think we had a slide in between here. This is in, yes, on my slides. I'm sorry. So, yeah, let's go back to mine.
You're ahead.
Okay. The crossroads I'd like to share with you relative to the performance program and genetic evaluation are many. And we're not going to get into much detail here, but already it's no secret that the institutions that conduct genetic evaluation have indicated that they'd like to transition out of the service component of that business and put that in the hands of either individual breeds or a multi-breed type entity, and they'd like for that to happen sometime within the next 1 or 2 years. So we have a huge transition happening in our industry relative to movement from public to private service providers for multi-breed genetic evaluation. Currently, within 3 out of the top 7 breeds, we have multi-breed genetic evaluation technology in place. But still, there's 4 of the 7 of the biggest breeds that have not yet implemented multi-breed technology. We're also moving from within population to across populations, aren't we? Where we see multiple herd books combining together for the purposes of genetic evaluation. And that is among the very highest priority projects currently being undertaken by the National Beef Cattle Animal Evaluation Consortium. So it's a huge leap. We are moving rather rapidly, in my opinion, and justifiably so, to a time when all animals, regardless of breed or breed cross, can be fairly compared. We also are moving from existing methodology to quantum leap. And the example of that is use of random regression, whereby any weight collected on any animal at any age is used to contribute to the animal's genetic prediction. And isn't that wonderful for those of you that are seed stock producers? Because then no longer will animals be out of age limits and not have their record contribute to their genetic predictions. We're also moving rapidly in most circles from domestic evaluations to international evaluations. So we're including not only multiple breeds, but multiple countries. And we're also, I think, now at the cusp of having the technology readily available to move from periodic to very continuous evaluations. Right now, if you were CEO of the beef seed stock industry and you just got done making breeding decisions for the spring breeding season, isn't it silly that we're operating on data that's 5.5 months obsolete, given the cutoff dates of November for submission of data to our genetic evaluations? Isn't that unfortunate? We're losing almost a whole year of time. And so that's really a tragedy, given that the technology exists to run these much more frequently. And we're also moving very rapidly from quantitative information only to the existence of a lot of qualitative information. So with that said, we're going to move into the second area, and I have a few questions to ask here. Have you tested, in the case of a seed stock producer, or used in the case of a commercial producer, any of the DNA diagnostics for marbling or tenderness? I think those are the two main quantitative traits for which DNA diagnostics exist. Now, Marianne, I believe the first results will be for everyone. And for the majority, no, but it's about 50-50. The next set of results coming up are for seed stock, as designated at the bottom. So over half of you seed stock producers have at least sampled these DNA diagnostics. And for commercial, less than half, but it's a pretty equal split. So these diagnostics are certainly gaining traction among the ranks of seed stock and commercial. Next slide. And we want you to answer this real comfortably, because it will help us with regard to educational efforts. How comfortable are you with your understanding of DNA diagnostics for marbling and tenderness? A response of 1 is uncomfortable. You don't feel like you understand those tools. A response of 2 is somewhat uncomfortable and slightly confused. A response of 3 is somewhat comfortable and that you have a working knowledge of those tools. And 4 is comfortable, strong understanding. Now we're just going to display all the results here all at once. And I see the most common response is 3, somewhat comfortable working knowledge. Good. So we've done a reasonable job of getting many up to speed. Still, the fact that over 1/3 are uncomfortable and confused represents a fairly large educational challenge for the DNA service providers as well as for the breeds. Last question on this area. Do multiple sources of genetic information for the same trait, and I want to use the trait marbling in this instance, simplify or confuse your selection decisions? I'd like to explain just a little bit. For example, for marbling, you'd have an EPD for marbling. In some breeds, you'd have a separate EPD for IMF as an indicator of marbling. You'd also, from the 3 different primary DNA service providers, have GeneStar marbling type information, have Igenity score type information, and have MMI molecular genetic value type information. So, does multiple sources of information for the same trait, in this case marbling, simplify selection once you understand the tools? Does it slightly confuse selection? Does it somewhat confuse selection? Or does it create significant confusion that may even impede response to selection? So we'd like your opinion on that. Survey says most of you say it at least somewhat confuses selection. So we'd have a fair amount of confusion that is introduced when there's multiple sources of information for the same trait. Okay? So I think some of this leads up to the many crossroads and the huge, the monumental transition that we're facing right now with regard to incorporation of genomic information. We're so thankful that these companies have invested so much of their capital and human resources and taken the risk to develop some of these tests and continue to try to develop tests. But we've got a lot of questions to answer, don't we? We need better validation techniques. We need stronger relationships with breeds and service providers and entities that are developing tests. We've got a lot of operational questions to talk about. But for me, the one thing I wanted to visit with you about relative to genomics, it's all a matter of context, isn't it? The confusion comes in that the EPD is the established context, but the context in which the DNA test results are presented is different. And that's what creates the confusion. I don't know how many of you recently saw the article this spring in the, I think it was in the New York, or no, in the Washington Post about the violin virtuoso Joshua Bell. Did many of you read this? I thought it was so interesting. Joshua Bell is a 39-year-old virtuoso that's world-renowned in his ability to play the violin. And he commands sold-out performances everywhere he goes, and no seat sells for less than about $100 a seat. But just for fun, the Washington Post newspaper hired him to dress up like a bum, take his $3 million Stradivarius violin, go to the subway, open his violin case, and play for 1 hour, and see how much attention and how much money he earned. And interestingly enough, in the context of the concert hall, he plays the sold-out performances. It generates thousands of dollars for an hour-long performance. How much money do you think he made playing for 1 hour in the subway? He had a grand total of 24 people chip in $39. And it exemplifies that in the wrong context, something is worth considerably different amounts. And you might blame it on marketing, or you might chalk it all up to context. But in the context of separate selection tools that are not linked and not of the same common language, or as Mike Tesh used yesterday, the same common currency, we run the risk of devaluing the use and the applicability of that technology. But I thought that was an interesting story to go with there. So for my money, on the genomic side, a good question to ask is, for a trait such as marbling that's moderately heritable, how much would a DNA diagnostic, enhanced EPD, where all the DNA data is going into the EPD, be worth if you could increase accuracy from, say, a pedigree or a pedigree plus level to, say, a level of 0.7 or higher? That puts it in a context that I think is easy for we as seed stock producers to understand. Next, just a couple of quick questions. This has to do with the use of decision support. And the most common form of decision support are indexes, aren't they? Because they are a marriage of the economics with the selection information. So I wanted to ask you a question. How much do you emphasize the current selection index information, for example, the dollar beef values published by Angus, the dollar all-purpose index published by Semitol, for example, when making breeding decisions? So a response of one is that you do not use the index information. A response of two is you put low emphasis. A response of three is you put moderate emphasis. Or a response of four is you put high emphasis. Survey says that most of you put 38% emphasis, but 47%, nearly half, put none or low emphasis. That's very interesting, Wade Schaefer. We've got our work cut out for us relative to having people emphasize index information more in their selection decisions. Very interesting. Relative to the crossroads or the period of transition we're at on decision support, I think is monumental, because with ever-expanding information and ever-expanding demands on our time, we need better tools, don't we, to sift through it and make sense of it all such that we can leverage the information across the most profitable decisions possible. Right now, we're at static indexes, but much work is being done by your Animal Breeding Genetics Consortium relative to building tools that allows you to, on a customized basis, provide input about your herd, your management, your marketing, and then have the computer help you emphasize traits to an appropriate economic amount. And it's really about coping with the complexity and the volatility that we see in the marketplace. And it's about trying to make sense of the very complex interactions between genetics and management. So we see a huge crossroads with regard to development of decision support and a need for smart people to model these sorts of things. Last few questions. We want to know how much on average you paid for bulls over the past 2 years. And we'll break it out separately later, but we just want to know average for the group. We only care about the overall group for display. Did you pay less than $2,000, $2,000 to $3,000, $3,000 to $4,000, greater than $4,000, or do you produce your own bulls? Good. We've got pretty good spenders in this group, and we appreciate the support that you give our seed stock producers when you buy bulls. Interestingly enough, though, look, 28% of you just produce your own bulls. Isn't that interesting? A couple of other quick questions. Which of the following? Now this is all, in a sense, setting things up. We know that we've got a lot of dollars in this business. And we know we've got very few dollars of financial support. We know that something's got to give if we're going to adequately cope with many of these transitions. So we're trying to test your willingness to pay for different things. Which of the following best describes your willingness to pay for more advanced performance recording and genetic evaluation services? And more advanced, I mean for more traits. More advanced, I mean multi-breed. More advanced, I mean more comparable across a larger portion of our whole cattle population. By more advanced, I mean better decision support tools. One, are you not willing to pay any more? Things are already too high. Two, would you be willing to pay a little more, up to 10%? Three, willing to pay somewhat more, 10 to 25%? Or four, willing to pay a lot more? Survey says 17% of you think prices are already too high, and I can empathize with that. Although, fortunately, most of you are willing to pay at least a little more, obviously, if you can see the value in that investment. Next question. Which of the following best describes your willingness to pay for more thoroughly evaluated and reliable seed stock? In other words, seed stock that have genetic predictions in one form or another for more traits, and have higher accuracy genetic predictions for those traits. One, are you not willing to pay more? Seed stock's already too high priced. Two, would you be willing to pay a little more? Three, willing to pay somewhat more? Or four, willing to pay a lot more? Question here is, how much more valuable would it be if you had additional traits, be it those that span the reproductive complex of traits, be it those that span traits such as efficiency, and if you had higher accuracy EPDs available for those traits? Survey says most of you would be willing to pay at least a little more, and in some cases a fair amount more. And God bless you, it'd be worth it, wouldn't it? It'd be worth it because you wouldn't have to suffer the opportunity cost, or you wouldn't have to build in the risk associated with the selection we have today, because you know that in one trait or another, most animals are going to underperform. Relative to we at breed associations, we run fairly simple businesses in that we process data to get revenue, and then we reinvest that revenue in marketing and in various programs and to a certain small extent in research. We got a lot of transitions on the horizon relative to breed associations, and most of us are in one or another stage of these transitions that are listed here. We're moving from animal to inventory-based systems. We're moving from paper systems to paperless systems and shifting the burden of data input to breeders. And we're also trying to save on postage, paper, printing, and all these production costs by maximizing the use of the Internet. We're also moving from batch systems to real-time systems so that we can give you instant gratification regarding the data that you submit. We're also moving from recording just individual breed information to recording hybrids, and in some breeds, more than one hybrid. And we're transitioning from quantitative to molecular and from passive, and we need to transfer from passive to more assertive producer education. So the last thing that I'd like to use as a segue to Dr. Green is we're also at a crossroads relative to leadership, aren't we? We are ever so challenged to bridge this knowledge gap between what's available technologically and what's understood and applied back home on our farms and ranches. We're also at a crossroads relative to capital and knowing where the money's going to come from to support these various activities, as well as at a crossroads on public policy. What we really need to think about, I think, during today and tomorrow and the time ahead, is how can we position BIF to serve our industry even better in the next 40 years. And what we need to think about is what is our vision for BIF and the breeds and all the service providers of this country such that we can remain competitive in the global marketplace, such that we can cooperate with one another and do more together than apart, such that we can coordinate our infrastructure to be able to compare animals across a wider volume of a population, and so that we can more comprehensively evaluate animals. You've been a great audience. I only hope that the innovative spirit that caused the formation of BIF grows stronger and lives all the more in the next 40 years. Thank you very much.